Good morning, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, June 12th, and today in the fireside is Bob Ekblad, and he will be presenting The Promise Threatened but Claimed, Oppression and Resistance in Exodus. The session number is EKB 2000-1. Now let's just sit back, relax, and have a listen.
Today's session is called The Promise Threatened but Claimed, Oppression, Resistance, and Liberation in Exodus and in the USA. The promise of new life threatened and claimed oppression and resistance in Exodus is today's theme, which we'll be looking at Exodus chapter 1 and 2. But first of all, actually, I'd like us to look at some of the text that where the promises is expressed, is articulated. And I have those, just a few of them listed here. And if someone could read, people could, a volunteer could read Genesis 1, 28. I'd appreciate it.
God bless them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it. And have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth.
Okay. Now this, one of the problems that people get into sometimes when you read the text about promise is that are these texts that are primarily directed to the Jewish people, or to the people of Israel, or is this more universal? And in this particular text, it's the, you know, Adam doesn't get his name. It could be argued that Adam doesn't get his name until about chapter 4, verse 25, based on the Hebrew, you know. So this is the human, right? I mean, Adam comes from Adama, which is like the earth or the ground. And this is the human one, the male and female, who are given this promise, which, you know, invites us to read this as a pretty universal promise, to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over every living thing that moves upon the earth. And many of these other texts are like that as well, and then others get more specific. They're promises to, you know, say to Abraham or whatever. But why don't we keep reading? Someone read 6:18.
I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall come into the ark, you, your sons, your wives, and your sons' wives with you.
Okay, so that's, why don't we move to 9, chapter 9, verse 1, actually.
God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth.
Okay. And there's more specifics about what that means later on in the text, but we're not going to get into too much detail about the promise here. I'd like to just evoke it as much as possible. How about chapter 12, verse 1 to 4? Here's the promise to Abraham. Abram.
Now the Lord said to Abraham, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you I will curse, and in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So Abraham went as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Abraham was 75 years old when he departed from Haran.
Okay. Why don't we skip 15:12? And 15:12 is important because it describes how the people will go through this oppression and exodus. You know, the people will go through this period of going into Egypt, but then they'll be liberated out. You know, it's described to Abraham that his offspring will be there. His offspring will be aliens in a land that's not theirs. Okay. Well, let's move to 17:1-8.
When Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, I am God Almighty. Walk before me and be blameless, and I will make my covenant between me and you, and it will make you exceedingly numerous. Then Abram fell on his face, and God said to him, as for me, this is my covenant with you. You shall be the ancestor of a multitude of nations. No longer shall your name be Abram, but your name shall be Abraham, for I have made you an ancestor of a multitude of nations. I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings shall come from you. I will establish my covenant between me and you, and your offspring after you throughout their generations, for an everlasting covenant to be God to you and to your offspring after you. give to you and your offspring after you the land where you now are now an alien, all the land of Canaan, for perpetual holding, and I will be their God.
And then finally, let's look at 22:16 and following. Let's see how far we should read. 16 to 18.
The angel of the Lord said, "By myself I have sworn, says the Lord, because you have done this, have not withheld your son, your only son. I will indeed bless you, and I will make your offspring as numerous as the stars of heaven and the sand that is on the seashore. And your offspring shall possess the gate of their enemies. And by your offspring shall all the nations of the earth gain blessing for themselves, because you have obeyed my voice."
Okay. So what are some of the promises here that have been expressed through these scriptures? What would be the good news here, I guess? Some people would see this as bad news, you know, population explosion, here we are. what is the promise?
A great nation.
Okay, so
a great nation, what else?
Prosperity.
Prosperity. Now remember, in the very first scripture that we read, Genesis 1:28, dominion over and, you know, all of these things, this is talking about for everybody, right? For the whole human race. Okay. So, I mean, there are ways to, that text has been abused, and many environmental ethicists and lots of sensitive people have noticed that this text has been the justification for, you know, for just the rape of the environment, and it has indeed, but that doesn't take away the good news of that text to the people who it was being addressed to, who were primarily exiles and powerless people, Genesis chapter 1. Well, anyway, great nation, prosperity, dominion. But dominion for all. Well, what else do we have here?
Covenant.
Okay. But all of this is part of the promise that God is covenanting to do all these things through the people.
But he also says, "And I will be your God."
And I will be your God.
Uh-huh. All the nations will be blessed through Abraham.
Okay, all the nations. Okay, so blessing for all the nations through the offspring of Abraham. You have to ask the question, blessing. Does blessing mean, you know, all the things that have been mentioned above?
Should.
Okay. So blessing for all nations through Abraham's offspring. Then the question becomes, well, what does it mean to be an offspring of Abraham? And, you know, some people would define that exclusively, and other people would define it more broadly. I've told a group here before that I once said that I was a Jew in order to get on a kibbutz in Israel for about a hulupan. You study Hebrew, have to have a special deal for immigrants. And I justified it based on Galatians, where it says that through Christ, our faith in Christ, we're all children of Abraham, right? And I looked pretty Jewish. And I was all brown and curly haired. Okay, anything else that anyone has here that I've noticed here from these texts?
I need to talk about our definition of dominion.
I'm not going to in this. That's actually, well, we'll get there in a way. In a way, we'll get there. Okay, so what I'd like to do, we have a little bit of an idea of what this is. Knowledge of God, dominion over all the forces that are oppressive to us normally. You know, one thing we have to remember about dominion is that, you know, in Campesino culture, Central America, people are glad to have dominion over all of the diseases that destroy their cornfields and their bean fields and You know, dominion is a bad word for us, but if you're a small farmer who's a subsistence farmer in some impoverished country, you know, where hurricanes sweep through and, you know, your lands are eroded, and nature's not looked upon as your buddy. Okay? Nature is a violent, destructive force that is always throwing something at you, you know, some worm or fungus or you know, or torrential downpour or a drought. And so to have dominion over the earth is good news for folks who, you know, pre-penicillin people, right? And pre-Gore-Tex people. And it's easy for us to kind of to look down and maybe just to completely miss the good news about dominion because of our place of privilege and the way we're sheltered by our technology. Okay, so that's my one little word about dominion. I'll say more later on. Okay, well, why don't we read, look at Exodus now. And read the first seven verses of Exodus.
These are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, and Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. Total number of people born to Jacob was 70. Joseph was already in Egypt. Then Joseph died, and all his brothers, and that whole generation. But the Israelites were fruitful and prolific. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them.
Okay, here we have just a few observations here. We have, we're reminded that the people who have been given the promise of the land, by the way, we forgot to mention that, the land, okay, and all of these blessings, they're in a foreign land, okay, they're uprooted, they're in Egypt, they're in exile. On the other hand, we have the mention of 70 people who were born to Jacob. Okay? Now, some people who are more literalists in their scripture reading would say, okay, 70, and they number everybody up and they figure it all out. I think they're missing the point, and there's many Bible scholars that have noticed that you know, the symbolic nature of numbers, and 70 is a number of that signifies the totality, like a number of completion. Okay, so a way to read this in the beginning is that, hey, this promise was realized. Jacob had the total number. You know, that he was fruitful and he multiplied. I mean, this is a realization of the promise. And Kasuto, who's a rabbi who's now no longer alive, but he writes, just as the nations of the entire world number 70, according to Genesis 10, so the children of Israel total 70. They form a small world that parallels the great world, a microcosm. Corresponding to the macrocosm. Okay. So we're, if we're careful readers, we'll notice, you know, we'll notice this, or if we're informed readers, it's hard to be informed about that, I guess, unless you're a Bible scholar, but we can take note that this we're invited to see this people as a microcosm. Okay, the problem is, what happens in verse 6? In that whole generation, okay? So this totality is finite. It's wiped out. It dies. Okay, so the promise is threatened right in the opening of the book of Exodus. Now this is nothing new. The promise was threatened all the way from the start. I mean, just think of what happens right after Genesis 1:28. You know, you have chapter 2 and 3. You have, the promise is threatened. It's subverted by the tempter, and by the weakness of those who were tempted and who were expelled from this place of promise, the garden, right? And they end up in exile outside the garden. What other threats are there in the book of Genesis to the promise? Can people remember any?
Abraham gave his wife away twice.
Exactly. Okay, the possibility that this source of of the descendant, the offspring, is suddenly going to have is going to get impregnated by, you know, some foreign power, and the whole promise is going to be subverted. Or even before that, the sterility of Abram and Sarah, the fact that they couldn't have any children. I mean, there's a major threat. And then what happens when Isaac's born? He almost gets sacrificed. Okay, he is he almost sacrifices the child of the promise. Okay, so I mean, this is a fragile, precarious promise that is continually being threatened. Think of Jacob. You know, what would happen if Isaac hadn't been deceived? He would have recognized that the second born, who was the chosen one, you know, was not the firstborn. Or what if Laban had succeeded in turning Jacob into his permanent slave? You know, or what about Esau? If he'd been a little more macho than he already was, and instead of just being hairy red and, you know, and the firstborn, he would have also killed his brother, Jacob. Okay? And then we have many other threats. I mean, you know, Joseph ends up being thrown in a pit, okay, and then a famine comes, and famine could have wiped out, you know, all of Jacob and his family, but no, Joseph was rescued out of the pit, you know, and then he ends up in a prison, right? So all the way along, I mean, these are just a few examples. The book of Genesis is full of this drama of the promise being threatened and constantly reaffirmed, okay? Reaffirmed and threatened and practically wiped out. Or Babel, think of Babel. I mean, here you have the promise threatened by togetherness. You know, all the people, they don't want to be scattered over the face of the earth. They want to form a congregation. No, I'm just kidding. They want to be there, and so the promise is threatened by this desire to build a name for yourself. Okay, and it's God's intervention that comes and scatters the people so that the promise can be fulfilled. All right, well, let's look at what happens in the next verse in chapter 1 of Exodus, verse 7. So we have death. The whole generation, the 70, they die. So the promise. Okay, the promise. That was a nice idea. Finitude won out. Death wins in this situation. What happens in verse 7? Could you read the whole thing again?
But the Israelites were fruitful and prolific, and multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so the land was filled.
In our own oppression, is through just being seduced or distracted by these, you know, by other idols, other forces, and so we have this lack of connection, this lack of spirituality. I don't know if that works. What are those louder voices?
Well, those things.
What else?
You listed, you know, those are the other voices that we are being barraged by. And we don't know how anymore sometimes to be still, you know, to listen to the voice of God.
Yeah, exactly.
Voices like television and computer industry.
Okay, if we get a little more concrete here, we say oppressors, okay.
Market force.
Malls.
The oppressors, okay. Malls. Okay, multinationals. Multinationals. Garage sales.
World Trade Organization.
WTO, World Trade Organization, okay. Someone else said something else there. TV. Definitely. Okay, the media.
Computers.
The internet. The web, right? The web is liberating force.
Yeah, sure.
Stock market.
Cell phones.
Cell phones. So technology.
Yes.
Hey, wait a minute. Technology was designed to save us time.
It does that. Worship time.
Okay.
another way to tie this to is the year of Jubilee and the Leviticus text. There's a lot of things that we need to do in the 50th year. And one of them that we miss commonly is rest. And that sort of ties that together. Stop working. Stop planting in the field. Rest. But we've been driven by market forces. We won't do it.
Okay, well, one of the forces is work. And we're driven by market forces, but how do the oppressed participate in their oppression? We let themselves be driven by work. We buy more, okay.
Credit card, yes.
Debt.
We don't have a clear definition of ourselves, and without a clear definition, because we are so distracted, and without a clear definition of ourselves, we cannot act out of our own being. We always have to be reacting to the forces rather than being proactive,
so we're alienated because we are bombarded by distractions and we are letting ourselves be distracted.
Okay.
Distractions. Distractedness. Okay. So the oppressors, all these, the oppressors are good at inspiring or distracting us. Now you guys, it's interesting. We pretty much have the principalities and powers here. But we don't have the passions. This is one thing I notice in mainline circles. It's like the passions are not even discussed. I mean, you know, what about, well, some of the passions are here, greed. I mean, say you take this, the eight deadly passions of the Eastern Orthodox Church tradition, right? First one is gluttony. Second one is lust. Okay, that's why the best way to avoid or to minimize lust is to eat less. That's why some of these desert fathers were eating like little crumbs of bread with no salt. And, you know, because they were having a hard time out there in their caves without their wives or whatever. Anyway, gluttony, lust, greed,
sloth,
anger, sloth,
addictions.
You know, the first thing that people that I work with, I do a Bible study on Genesis and Exodus 2, and the forces are completely different. Well, not completely different. Many are the same, but here, in terms of the oppressors, it's courts, the jails, the INS. I mean, it's so easy for them to come up with these lists. It's cocaine, it's heroin, it's cerveza, beer, it's the desire for riches. You know, the North, the Norte, the vision, the American dream. And they're seduced, I mean, they're oppressed by the American dream. They know they don't have so many things. So they're willing to sacrifice a lot to this dream, right? And they feel oppressed by it because making minimum wage, I mean, how are you going to make get the dream if you're making minimum wage at Jack in the Box or picking strawberries or cucumbers or something? I mean, of course you're going to be tempted to sell drugs. So, I mean, you know, drugs, the list is different.
Those are the things that present themselves to them.
Right.
And these are the things that present themselves to us.
Exactly.
So it's sort of like the oppressor will manifest himself through whatever vehicle is evident.
Right. Exactly. So this particular question, what are the forces that threaten the promise? This is something we could ask. I mean, each one of us have different forces that threaten us. And the purpose of this exercise is to get us to reflect a bit on what those forces might be for us, right? But in every context, it's going to be unique. You went to a Native American community, you know, anywhere here in Washington State, you have a totally different list. If you went to a nursing home, you have a different list. If you went to Central America, to Honduras, where I work 3 weeks out of every year, you have a completely different list. Okay, so this is a contextual, this brings up the question of our context, and that context will vary. But what I'd like to do is move now to see how Exodus might be good news for us. Someone read chapter 1 of Exodus, verses 8 through chapter 2, verse 10. But before we read, I want to ask one more question just to be thinking about. Where is God in the midst of all this? How do we identify God in the midst of all this?
He's always there.
Okay. Okay.
But we don't commit.
Okay, well, think about that question when we read these verses. Where was God in the midst of all this? The promise is being threatened. It's being there are forces that are trying to extinguish this promise and wipe it out. Yet there's something happening that is it's pretty special in these chapters. Do we have a reader?
I'll read.
Exodus 1, chapter verses 8 through 2. Or why don't we have two readers? 1-8 to the end of the chapter, and then chapter 2, verses 1 to
okay. Now, 10. When the king arose over Egypt, he did not know Joseph. He said to his people, "Look, the Israelite people are more numerous, more powerful than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, or they will increase, and in the event of war, join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to oppress them with forced labor. They built supply cities, Pithom and Ramesses for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread, so that the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. The Egyptians became ruthless in imposing tasks on the Israelites, and made their lives bitter with hard service and mortar and brick and in every kind of field labor. They were ruthless in all the tasks that they imposed on them. The king of Egypt sent it with Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shifra and another Puah. When you act as midwives to the Hebrew women and seat them on the birth stool, if it is a boy, kill him, but if it is a girl, she shall live. But the midwives feared God. They did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but they let the boys live. So the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this and allowed the boys to live?" The midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them." So God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very strong. And because midwives feared God, he gave them families. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, "Every boy that is born to the Hebrews, you shall throw into the Nile, but you shall let every girl live."
Now a man from the house of Levi went to marry a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw that he was a fine baby, she hid him 3 months. When she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and plastered it with bitumen and pitch. She put the child in it and placed it among the reeds on the bank of the river. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. The daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the river while her attendants walked beside the river. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her maid to bring it. When she opened it, she saw the child. He was crying, and she took pity on him. "This must be one of the Hebrews' children," she said. Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and get you a nurse from the Hebrew women to nurse this child for you?" Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Yes." So the girl went and called the child's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child and nurse it for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed it. When the child grew up, she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and she took him as her son. She named him Moses, because, she said, "I drew him out of the water."
Okay, so in this story, who are the oppressors? Can we get more specific about that? Who are the actors in the oppression?
Pharaoh.
Okay.
Pharaoh, taskmasters.
Okay, the leadership, the officials.
At the end, he tells all the Egyptians, any male baby to throw in, so he gets them all in one.
Okay, Egyptians, the whole people. Yep. So there's kind of a, if we're looking at the most powerful down to what we're going to eventually do is move this from the most powerful to the least in terms of the characters, get a list of characters here. But what are the means that Pharaoh uses? for the oppression of the Egyptian, of the Israelites. Why is he threatened in the beginning? What is afraid. His? What's that?
He's afraid.
Okay, he's afraid. What's he afraid of?
The numbers. There'll be more of them. In the event of war, join our enemies and fight against okay. the state from the land.
Power there. He's got a threat of loss of power. Multiplication.
It's interesting. If you look at all of these, you know, all of these the oppressed, the things that forces that oppress us and the actual oppressors. You know, one question to be asked: why are we seduced? You know, what are the things that motivated us to allow ourselves to be distracted? You know, by these forces. What are the underlying issues that make us vulnerable to distraction of this sort, these sorts of distractions? You know.
I took a course once with a football coach, and he was the we were going to teach his class, the teachers of drug awareness kind of class. So he had us list all our addictions first night. At the end of it, he said, well, this is a very interesting list. You know, we have PCP and all those kinds of drugs on the list and whatever. And then he said, now I'm going to put on the board that every person in this country is addicted to. And he turned around and he wrote the word comfort. When you think about that, a connection with this, you know, our comfort zone, whatever we, however we define that, has to do with, you know, when we don't feel threatened, either by powers or whatever, so we do that stuff, I think, and we get sucked into believing that that's important in order to maintain something, you know, about us.
Okay, there's things we do then out of fear, and out of fear of loss of comfort, loss of privilege. Like, what sorts of things might we do then? Come out of that.
We're in computers, so we're not the only dummy in the block, you know.
We can check our stock portfolio on a
daily basis.
So anyway, some of the issues here of fear, insecurity. We're seeing right in the very beginning about with Pharaoh, aren't we? So what are the so we see Pharaoh as someone who's threatened by this incredible life force, okay, that is just kind of blossoming in the face of death, in the face of being even in exile. What are the means that the Pharaoh uses to stifle the promise?
Genocide.
Okay, is that what's the first thing though? If we look chronologically at this, genocide is definitely part of the picture. But if we looked chronologically.
Overwork, hard work.
Okay, hard work. Okay. So make them work. There are a number of Hebrew terms that appear here. In fact, Kasuto may go sort of far here. He talks about how there are seven terms that talk about the blessing in Exodus 1:7. You know, the sons of Israel were fruitful and teemed and became numerous and they became vast with many, many, and the earth was full of them. There's seven, okay? Well, there are seven corresponding terms of oppression, okay, that can be identified. And there's a little bit of kind of finagling that he has to do to note seven. But anyway, there are a similar number. Maybe there's even eight. Maybe there are more. And these are... you know, the Pharaoh causes the people to serve with harshness, with severity, making their lives bitter, with severe labor, with mortar and bricks, and with all the labor in the open field, with all their labor, which they labored with harshness. Okay? So the objective is, what would be the objective of doing that? To break their spirits? Okay.
Especially when you did not have the straw and told them they had to use the same amount of bricks.
Okay. Now, when they're working, what aren't they doing?
Celebrating,
okay. So work is a distraction. That is, the means that the Pharaoh is using to keep people oppressed is distraction. He's got the people so busy, that so distracted, that they can't organize. They can't say, hey, we got to get rid of these Egyptian taskmasters.
And they're probably so tired that they're
So work is the opiate of the people. I hear all this stuff, worship our, you know, celebrate our vocation, celebrate our work. Work is really up on a pedestal these days. I think there's a need for some major unmasking.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay,
it kills people off. You know, we lost 3 colleagues in my institutional wellness last year, and they were described later on after their demise as having been so stressed. You know, what's with that?
Okay, so stress is a major consequence of this workaholism.
Huh? But that's context, yeah, contextual again, because outside of the chief seven nations, work is not killing people. It's doing a different way. Stress and heart rate disease is not killing people.
Right.
Very common.
That's right.
They got a different model.
That's right. So a lot of Mexican farm workers come up from areas where they're suffering from those sorts of diseases. And Honduran peasants, they're coming up to Vancouver, BC. In droves, okay, from villages where we work down in Honduras, we used to work. But these folks, what they're finding is they're working. What they're offered is fish processing plant jobs for 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. That's the most popular job in our county right now, because in that particular job they do get overtime. They get minimum wage plus, you know, time and a half or whatever for the overtime. But they're working 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. As soon as the strawberry harvest begins, people will be working from sunup to sundown 7 days a week. As long as there's a harvest, they'll be working throughout the whole summer, all the way until October. Try starting a ministry with folks that are working like that. Yeah. That's one of the great advantages of being chaplain of the jail is, you know, people end up getting into trouble, okay, because they're working so hard and they're afraid of the authorities. They don't want to go get their licenses, so they get warrants for their arrests, and they're trying to tranquilize themselves through drugs and alcohol sometimes, you know, and they drink a little too much and they go out driving, they end up in jail, okay, and they have time. They have time. One of the rare things that they experience, the moments when they experience time is when they're in jail, and that's when I have 2 Bible studies a week with those folks, and they're thirsty for this. But work is they're enslaved to work. And if they want to escape the slavery, oftentimes they're seduced into the drug trafficking scene, you know, because that's a fast way to make fast money. It sure beats, you know, doing hard labor, stoop labor for minimum wage. And so there are lots of people that end up getting seduced into that. In fact, in Vancouver, the main drug runners now on the streets of Vancouver, BC, are Honduran peasants, most of them under 18. So anyway, the first step is work, and what happens? What's the result of that strategy to use work? It doesn't work. Okay, what happens? What does the text tell us?
They continue to multiply.
Okay, so in the face of the death force, the life force, you know, the promise is threatened, but it's God is somehow at work or in the people, and the people flourish. Okay, the next means are what? Okay, so genocide is the next means. And here Pharaoh harnesses his own population, right? No, he doesn't. He tries to take two of the people themselves, 2 midwives, and engage them in his genocide activity, right? And then we know from the story that they resist. Okay, then what does Pharaoh do? And not only do they resist, but what happens, actually?
They have families.
What's that?
They have families.
They have families themselves, okay. So God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very strong, and because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Okay, so the life force is not stopped. The promise is not threatened. It's threatened, but it's reclaimed. What happens next?
Just on that point, there's also that humorous line in there, too, that the midwives are saying, well, you know, we would do that if we could do that, but, you know, these people are so bigger. These women are so strong and healthy that, you know, babies are already there before we even get there. So that, in other words, it's that sense of being fruitful and multiplying and is already there before any assistance can come along. God continues to strengthen.
Right, right. And the terms the midwives use for the women are like the, these women. They're not like these cultivated, sophisticated, Egyptian women. You know, like you guys, these are like animals. I mean, these, the poor, they just multiply, and I mean, they have babies standing up, Exactly. So it's interesting how we're going to talk about that in a few minutes, hopefully, if you guys can bear with me for 5 or 10 more minutes. The next means, then, is the attempt to wipe out the baby boys through engaging the whole population, right? With an order to take any boy that is of a certain age and throw it in the river. Okay. Okay. Well, who are the other participants in this? Who are the other characters in this story? Let's make a list of them really quick, all the way down from strongest to weakest.
The new king.
Okay. So Pharaoh. Pharaoh's daughter would be the next one.
Moses.
Okay, well, I want to start from strongest to weakest.
Maybe the midwives?
But we can put Moses on there,
okay?
Okay, the midwives? Actually, we have the Israelite overseers before that, or the Israelite overseers not show up in this passage yet.
Hebrew women.
Okay, Hebrew women. Okay, so Shifra and Pua. Hebrew midwives. Okay, who else? Okay, Moses' mother and sister. I'm going to put them above here, actually. We have the Hebrew women. Hebrew moms. Then we have a particular family, Moses' mother and father, right? Then we have Moses' sister. Baby Moses and anybody else? Israelite male babies.
Okay.
Baby Moses, male babies.
What about the other babies?
Okay, the other babies that are not mentioned, the female babies, they're in a place of privilege in a way because they're not identified, so they're up here somewhere. A little bit.
What?
Or they're not seen. Okay, so what are the means that Pharaoh uses besides, if we look more at the nature of oppression, Pharaoh, what is Pharaoh most threatened by? What is the enemy number one? What's public enemy number one for Pharaoh? Okay. So the possibility that these little babies will become big men who are soldiers.
Okay, but the loss of workers.
Loss of workers? Okay.
The power of the people that are multiplying is huge. They can overrun the country.
Okay.
They get organized.
Okay, but the main threat are the baby boys, right? Okay, so it's baby boys are the greatest threat to Pharaoh's power. And the means of, oppression, the strategies of oppression are all focused on destroying these male boys. So how does resistance happen? How does resistance happen to Pharaoh's project in this story?
The one is the behavior of God, and the other one is the fact that he's human.
first, where's the first sign of resistance in the story?
The midwives lie to Pharaoh.
Okay. So the midwives. The first sign of resistance is the midwives, because if you're God, and the means of resistance, lies, right? Deception. We're looking for an ethic of resistance here. Our first sign of an ethic would be, it would be sort of disturbing in a way, wouldn't it?
Actually, it's not that they lie. That's the first indication. They fail to act.
Okay, right. So non-compliance.
Right.
Okay, so the first act of resistance is non-compliance.
I would guess that it's eyes meeting eyes, women making friends, women looking at each other over the common task of having a baby and recognizing community among each other, even though they were from two different tribes and different kinds of people.
Okay.
And as soon as you become friends with someone, it's pretty hard to kill the baby.
Right. Okay, so just the bond of solidarity between these women. Women to women. It's interesting how these are the only people, they're the first people to have names in the story. Everyone else is just a force. Even the people are just the Israelites or whatever. I mean, you have the names of those that died, but then once the story starts in chapter, or verse 8, the first people with names, I mean, Pharaoh doesn't even have a name.
Not even his daughter.
Not even his daughter. Okay, the first people that have names are these two midwives who were slaves themselves, Shiphrah and Puah. And so the next means of resistance would be after Shiphrah and Puah. Who would that be? The daughter? Okay, the daughter is definitely one of the two. And that a critical one, Pharaoh's daughter. Okay, so Pharaoh's daughter is another one of the unsuspected resistors. How about before that?
Moses' mother.
Moses' mother, okay. And the Egyptian mothers, okay. The women are having babies. I mean, the means of resistance. You know, in a way, maybe it wasn't a deliberate, overt means of resistance, but I mean, it's part of God's project, right? To bring forth the life force, to resist the death force, is through these Hebrew moms who are having babies and dads. I don't know how much the dads were engaged. I mean, I know how they were engaged, but how consciously they were engaged in resisting. But anyway, the life force is happening. I mean, the resistance to the death force is happening so far through Shiphrah, through the two women midwives. Through Moses's, through the Hebrew moms, through Moses's mother. What does Moses's mother do? She protects. She hides the baby. Okay, so there's a resistance against authority. Okay, illegal activity here going on, and then finally we have the mother putting the child into the basket, you know, with some crazy kind of act of resistance and hope. Something might happen, and then the Moses' little sister who follows the baby, follows the basket, and then another woman who's Pharaoh's very daughter, who is part of the resistance movement, because she herself, knowing that this is a Hebrew baby, keeps the baby, right, and saves it and gives it to the daughter. Okay, so Pharaoh is threatened by baby boys, and who does God use to resist the powers of oppression in the story? Women. Okay. It's amazing. It's like God uses the most unsuspecting, the most unsuspected characters in the story, and really the weakest characters, or some of the weakest characters, to protect who? The very weakest of characters, right? So where is God in this story? If we had to identify God anywhere on this in this spot, in terms of God's solidarity, where would God be most closely identified? What's the resistance is all about what?
Looking through the oppressed.
Life. It's about life, promoting life, and
we're. So is God up here with Pharaoh at all? I mean, Pharaoh, do we see any signs that God is with the oppressor?
Well, it is to Pharaoh's family that the baby goes. So God uses Pharaoh too.
I think we can say fairly confidently that if God is identified anywhere in this story, God is with the babies. Okay? Because if God is working through the resistance of these women, the purpose of God, the location of God's of God in this story is with the weakest. You know, God is at the very bottom of the whole power structure, struggling for the promise through the weakest members, and using the means, some very unexpected means, you know, non-compliance, lying, you know, non-compliance and direct lying, non-compliance on the part of the Hebrew mothers, hiding. I mean, these are subversive acts, right? And so, I don't know, I think this, a careful read of Exodus gives us clues to the ways in which God might be present in the midst of, or, you know, might be calling and be present in the midst of our current structure. And I'm sorry we timed this wrong, or we ran out of time at this point, but we're going to be talking about these themes in the following days. And tomorrow we're going to be looking more closely at how God calls a liberator, and just what are the dynamics of that? What's happening? How does God call people to, you know, to be part of this liberating process? Thanks.